This episode of Observer Radio was recorded on Thursday, October 23rd. For updates on the stories discussed in this episode, visit texasobserver.org. Texasobserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. In the studio this week, we're joined by Observer editor Dave Mann. Dave, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Later in the show, we'll discuss this weekend's Texas Book Festival in Austin. We'll be joined by Observer managing editor Brad Tyer and Bryce Milligan of Wings Press to talk about the independent publishers who will be in attendance this weekend. But before we get to that, Dave Mann has been covering the legal saga of Ed Graff. In 1988, flawed arson evidence sent Ed Graff to prison for life. On Tuesday, at the end of a retrial, Graff pleaded guilty to two counts of murder and received a 60-year sentence. But because of a mandatory release policy, and this is the part we need your help to understand, that was in place at the time of his offense, Graff may be out in just a few months. So, Dave, help us make sense of all this, man. And maybe it would be best if we start at the beginning and understand Ed Graff's history.
Sure. So this was a fire that happened in August of 1986. And the facts that we know for certain are that Ed Graff came home on a Tuesday afternoon after picking his stepsons up at daycare. They got home with his two stepsons, who were 8 and 9 years old, and with his infant baby. And roughly about 20 minutes after they got home, a little before 5 o'clock, a fire broke out in the shed behind Ed Graff's house. And the fire department showed up on the scene, put the shed fire out, and at that time they discovered the bodies of the two boys. Ever since then, there's been what I would describe as a raging debate about how that fire started. And there are people outside of Waco, where Ed Graff lived, who are thoroughly convinced that he murdered his two stepsons. Mm-hmm. That includes his wife at the time, the boys' mother, Claire, then known as Claire Graff. She's since divorced Ed and is now known as Claire Bradburn. All his former in-laws, many of their friends, many people in Waco believe Ed Graff killed those two boys. There's a whole nother group of people in the Waco area who are equally convinced that Ed Graff was innocent.
Right.
And that when he was convicted in 1988 and sentenced to life in prison, that was a grave injustice and he was wrongly convicted. He received a life sentence. He served 25 years in prison on that life sentence. And then last year, in 2013, his conviction was overturned, and he was granted a new trial. And this month, that trial commenced. It lasted more than 2 weeks. And on Tuesday, we finally had a resolution. And as you mentioned, he pled guilty,
right,
which was a shocking development, I think, for a lot of people after Ed Graff had professed his innocence for almost 30 years, suddenly admit his guilt and receive a 60-year sentence. In this case, the key is in the details.
Yeah.
Right? Why did Ed Graff plead guilty? This is the overarching question. And the answer lies in the details of how Texas administers parole. The bottom line, we can get a little bit more into the details, but the bottom line is this. He, under the plea agreement, he receives credit for time served, his 25 years in prison, and time for good behavior. And when you add all that up, he is eligible for a mandatory release program policy that was in place in the 1980s. And under that policy, he's going to be released in 2 or 3 months.
So tell me about this mandatory release policy, though. Like, how did that come about? That's something we don't hear about a whole lot.
Right. So the backstory is basically that in the early 80s, Texas had a horrible prison overcrowding problem. I mean, not enough space to put all our prisoners. People sleeping on the floor. I mean, it was bad. As a result of that, the Texas legislature enacted this mandatory supervision policy to help address the prison overcrowding. Part of the problem, and this is just my understanding of it, part of the problem I've been told by the folks that study this is that there were people who were coming up for parole. They had short sentences because there was prison overcrowding. They were coming up for a parole hearing, and their sentence was going to expire in 2 years. And these were bad folks. These were folks who may have been given parole, but the state wanted to keep supervision of them. Remember, when you go on parole, you're not just out and free. There are strict guidelines you have to right. follow. And if you don't follow them, you're going to be revoked.
Sure.
Your parole will be revoked. You go back to prison. And so the state has an interest in maintaining supervision on what could be really bad people. So they had some very bad people coming up for parole and basically telling the parole board to go screw off, basically, because their sentence was going to be up in about 2 years and they didn't have to play with the parole board. And in 2 years, they'd be out free without the restrictions. So the motivation of this mandatory parole policy is when these people came up for parole, they had to take it. Like, there was no choice. It wasn't up to the parole board. It wasn't up to them. They had to go on parole. And the state's interest in that was to maintain supervision on some really bad people.
Right.
So that's why the policy was put in place in the 80s. Now, eventually, the prison overcrowding problem abated, and the legislature decided that this mandatory release program was flawed, mm-hmm. And they changed that policy in 1987. So this could not happen today.
Right.
Okay, and it hasn't happened. It hasn't been in place for more than 20 years. So why does this apply to Ed Graff?
Right.
It applies now to Ed Graff because under Texas law, when you are paroled, the rules governing your parole are the rules that were in place when your alleged crime took place, when your alleged crime happened. Now, the fire in this case that Ed Graff allegedly perpetrated happened in August of 1986, a year before the legislature changed the rules. So under Texas law, you have to go back to 1986 to figure out what rules would govern Ed Graff's parole. And in that sense, in that case, he is subject to this mandatory release policy. And because he received a 60-year plea agreement, he is now subject to mandatory release, mandatory supervision. And it is not up to the DA. It is not up to the parole board. In 2 or 3 months, as soon as they can process it, he will be released from prison. It's a real quirk of Texas law. It's a quirk that I think the defense in this case knew. I don't think the prosecution knew about it. I don't think they knew this was going to happen when they agreed to the plea.
Right.
And it's an open question about whether they would have agreed to the plea deal had they known it. But at the end of the day, basically you've got Ed Graff probably would have been convicted in this retrial. In fact, that's one of the great dramatic moments here, is that as soon as they finished the plea deal, while the jury was still deliberating, the bailiff came into the courtroom with a note from the jury saying, "We reached a verdict."
Right.
So it doesn't get much more dramatic than that.
Yeah.
And the verdict would have been guilty. Ed Graff would have been guilty. It's not clear if he would have been still subject to this parole policy if he'd been guilty. It kind of would have depended what his sentence had been, but it gets very complicated, but that's basically it. We had this mandatory release policy. It was in the 80s. Because Ed Graff's offense took place in the 80s, he's subject to this mandatory release. And a lot of prosecutors don't know about it. A lot of lawyers don't know about it. I certainly didn't know about it before this. But it's a bizarre ending to a very strange and a very tragic saga. That's kind of wound around for years. So we've got a lot in this case. We've got arson evidence. We've got, you know, scientists undermining that arson evidence. We've got prosecutors trying to convict Graff with almost no physical evidence, apparently being able to do so. We had a jailhouse snitch.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, one of the big points that you made, and I think one of the reasons you started covering this story to begin with, is you were looking at flawed arson cases, cases that involved arson evidence that has now been debunked as junk science. Can you explain that a little bit and how it relates to Ed Graff?
Sure, and that's how I got onto the Ed Graff story in the first place, is that we did a series back in 2009 on three flawed arson cases, mm-hmm. where people have been convicted on what is now clearly faulty arson evidence. And the background on that is that over the last 20 years, pretty much everything that we knew about fire and arson turned out to be wrong. And all of the indicators like burn patterns and certain cracks in glass and how you find out if gasoline is present at a scene, all these things that fire investigators thought were indicators of arson actually turned out not to be indicators of arson. And they used this evidence, this junk science, for decades to convict thousands of people. And all of that turned out to be wrong. A series of scientific experiments in the 90s and the 2000s undermined all this stuff. So there's been a big reexamination of arson cases, and Ed Graff's case has been part of that. So we did kind of the first big story on Ed Graff's case back in 2009. Mm-hmm. And so there's been an effort to get his case reexamined, along with other arson cases in Texas. And of course, the most famous being Cameron Todd Willingham, which is a name some people may recognize. And there are some similarities between Graff's case and Willingham's case here. Of course, Graff, the main difference is that Graff did not get the death penalty, and Willingham did, and he was executed in 2004. So there's a big effort to get Graff's case reexamined. As I mentioned, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the highest criminal court in Texas, looked at the Graff case in 2013. They said, yeah, this is all junk science. This does not conform to our modern understanding of fire. All this evidence is thrown out. We're overturning the conviction. He needs a new trial. Then at that point, it was up to local prosecutors to decide, do we charge him again and try for a retrial or just release him? And I think a lot of people thought he'd be released because all the key forensic evidence, all the arson evidence, all the physical evidence had been thrown out. All that was left was a lot of circumstantial evidence and witness testimony and, you know, stuff that makes for good trimmings on a case, but it's very difficult to build a case on. But prosecutors in Waco decided to go ahead with a retrial. And so we had a bizarre retrial over the last 2 weeks in which this was a test to see if you could really convict somebody without any physical evidence. Because all the physical evidence was on the side of the defense. They brought up all the fire scientists to say, hey, this was an accidental fire. We have all this science. We have all this testing to show that we believe this was an accidental fire. This was not an arson. But the prosecution, I mean, they did a good job trying the case. They put on a lot of compelling circumstantial evidence, things that have alternative explanations.
But, can you give us an example?
Well, there's two big examples, I would say. One is one big problem for Ed Graff was that he took out a life insurance policy on the boys a month before the fire.
Right.
That looks bad.
Sure.
That looks really suspicious. And that has been used time and time again to basically kind of prove his guilt. There's an explanation for it. And his Graff's explanation is that this was not a life insurance policy that you really would profit from, or you're not buying the life insurance because you think someone's going to die. It's a special kind of life insurance called universal life insurance, and it accrues value over time, and you can cash it out. And it's something a lot of people use as investment tools for their kids. In fact, Ed Graff had that very same universal life insurance policy when he was a kid. His father had gotten it for him. It accrued value, and he cashed it out and used it for his tuition at Baylor when he went to college. So Ed Graff thought this was a great idea, and he was going to do it for his two stepsons and his infant baby. Mm-hmm. And that was his explanation. And he says it's just bad luck and coincidence that a month later this fire happened. So it looks bad. But again, that's why it's circumstantial evidence, because it looks bad. It looks suspicious. But there are alternative explanations. And if you had solid proof that Ed Graff had done this crime, you could build your theory on the case with this circumstantial evidence. But it's difficult to prosecute a case based just off that. Another piece of circumstantial evidence was the fact that he had a gas can on his back porch. Physical testing, lab testing, showed no presence of gasoline in the shed. No gasoline on the floor. There's no evidence that there was gasoline used to start the fire. So what does it mean that there was a gas can on the back porch? Is that suspicious? Maybe a little, but lots of people probably keep gas cans on their back porch. So the prosecution would kind of bring that up over and over in the retrial and kind of say, well, there was this gas can on the back porch. And you can kind of spin that to make it seem suspicious. But at the same time, what does that really prove? Well, he had a gas can on his back porch.
Right.
That's what it proves. It doesn't say anything necessarily about whether he committed murder. And the last thing that probably had a big impact on the trial was a jailhouse informant. And that was the big piece of new evidence from the original trial to now. And he got up there and said, Ed Graff was in prison for 25 years and never said anything. And now, after his conviction's been thrown out and he's getting ready for a retrial, he suddenly confesses to this stranger in the McLennan County Jail in great detail. Like how he did it, how he dragged the boys into the shed, tied them up, set the fire, why he did it, all the, in incredible detail. Now, jailhouse informants, or as some people call them, jailhouse snitches, have a really problematic history. And in fact, the Innocence Project reports that jailhouse snitches play a role in about 18% of wrongful convictions. So there's some real problems with it. And I think a lot of people would look at this guy's testimony and not find it very believable. He had written to prosecutors asking for better treatment several times before he testified in this trial. But so, juries often find these guys believable. So the prosecution built their case on that circumstantial evidence and the jailhouse informant stacked up against the science. And in the end, that overwhelmed the science, and there was apparently going to be a guilty verdict.
Right.
So at the end of the day, what you have is, at the end of this, all of the, you know, this horrible tragedy where these kids died, a mother lost her children, this man went to prison, all the revolution about the arson science. I mean, there's so many trends here. At the end of the day, what you have is, apparently you can convict someone in Texas under the right circumstances with almost no physical evidence, and yet Ed Graff is getting out on what is essentially a technicality. So what do you take out of all that? I don't know, except that the criminal justice system can be really bizarre.
Well, Dave, it's a fascinating story, and you can read it too. It's called The Ed Graff Trial Ends in a Guilty Plea. It's on TexasObserver.org. Dave Mann, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Here in Austin, the Texas Book Festival will shortly be upon us. We're recording this episode on Thursday, October 23rd, meaning we're a mere 2 days away from more books and panels than you can wag a bookmark at. Of course, many of the state's indie presses will be there. Here to talk about the indie press experience at the book festival is Bryce Milligan of Wings Press. Welcome, Bryce.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Also with us is Observer Managing Editor Brad Tyer. Hey, Brad.
Hey. Bryce, first of all, thanks for joining us. For those who might not be familiar with Wings Press, which is probably nobody in Texas at this point, you guys are based in San Antonio, and you've got a really nice representation, I think, coming up at this festival. We did a piece, you spoke with our books editor, David Durer, for a piece that we've got up on our website right now about indie publishers at the festival. Tell me how important what is important, especially about the Texas Book Festival, to an independent press in Texas.
Well, of course, it's a great networking opportunity. It's a good chance to have some cash sales, and it's a lot of people can't get our books by walking into the bookstore because bookstores don't carry as many books as they used to, and so it's a really good chance for people to see literature that they wouldn't normally encounter.
And you're going to have a number of authors there represented at the festival as well, both at your tent and in various panels. Is that right?
Yeah, we've got five authors on different panels. Rosemary Katakalis, who was the Poet Laureate of Texas. Carmen DeFoya, who was the Poet Laureate of San Antonio. a mystery writer, Jay Brandon, Joe Hawley, former editor of The Observer, Carolyn Osborne, who was one of the founders of the book festival, and then on Sunday we'll have Dave Oliphant and Steve Schneider, two authors from Oliphant's from Austin and Schneider's from down the valley.
So not just an opportunity to put these books in front of, I think the audience is estimated at about 40,000, but to actually get some face time with the authors as well.
Absolutely. The authors hang around the booth, and they love talking to readers, and they enjoy meeting other writers. We're just down from the Texas Institute Letters booth, so there's a lot of writers that hang around there as well. So it's going to be a fun time.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to, I'm slowly over the years here at The Observer kind of collecting my meet and greets with former editors. I haven't had a chance to meet Joe Hawley yet. And I'm a little embarrassed to say I'm only just now, through her new book, getting familiar with Carolyn Osborne, who's a pretty wonderful writer that I wish I'd known about earlier.
Yeah, Carolyn is sort of a wonderful person. She's, like I said, she was one of the co-founders with Mary Margaret Farabee and Laura Bush of the original book festival. I think it was Carolyn that went off to Tennessee and saw a book fair there and came back and told Mary Margaret that it was wonderful and they should do it, and then they did it.
And now here we are, right. I wanted to touch real quickly on one of the issues that came up in the piece that that David wrote, and that's about the importance of reviews and promotion. And, of course, that's something that I think all the state's papers struggle with, some more efficiently than others, and something we certainly struggle with you know, the number of releases that come out and just having room to...
Well, it's so hard to get a review in the trade journals if you're an independent. And I've actually heard, you know, the editors of some of the major journals say that they're admitting to a Texas bias. So... I don't know exactly how to define that.
What would be the basis of it? Obviously, the state's full of well-known and well-regarded writers.
It certainly is, and I don't know. I think it's looking at Texas as a region and not as part of the mainstream of American publishing. It's not so much the writers as it is just, you know, what good can come from Texas, you know. But we are the source of a whole lot of diversity. There was just a panel recently sponsored by Lee and Lowe in New York talking about the lack of diversity in the publishing industry. And, you know, if they just look elsewhere, they'd find a lot of it.
Right.
Well over half my authors are Latina, and I publish about 70% women. I've got an anthology coming out next spring of Texas women, and it's a very diverse collection. And so diversity in publishing certainly is alive and well out here in the what some would consider the outback.
It sounds like we might be actually leading the way.
Well, I'm really glad you guys have brought this up. One of the questions I wanted to ask sort of relates to this. Bryce, you say in our piece that David Duer put together that Texas publishers have an opportunity to give a voice to those who have difficulty being heard. I was wondering if you could give us a specific example of that.
Well, when I started the press, it was very difficult for Latinas to get published. Actually, I didn't start the press when I took over the press in 1995. And so I just decided that that's who I would focus on. I'd been the book critic for the San Antonio Express News and had written a lot of book reviews during the Texas or the Chicano Movimiento, and
reviewed for us widely. We should mention back in the day.
Yeah, I used to be on your masthead at one time as a contributing writer, which was quite thrilling at the time. But I actually wrote the first review of House on Mango Street, Sandra Cisneros' classic, and so I've always been interested in, I've always said I'm in this for the revolution, so, you know, that's sort of where I'm at.
Excellent.
But a lot of these writers, I had a contest for a while for Latino writers from Texas under the age of 30, because it was almost impossible for them to even get into magazines, much less major publication. And then, you know, Sandra did a world of good by publishing with Random House in 1996 or whenever that was, 93, I think, for Woman Hollering Creek. And thereafter, I published an anthology with Putnam, Riverhead, of all Latinas, and then another one with Penguin, and those were both a consequence of Sandra having broken the ice.
Mm-hmm. Well, and has the situation, can we say that it's improved, or is it continue to be a difficult matter to get Latina voices into print?
Well, it's improved, but it's not nearly equitable.
Not all the way there yet.
No, not by a long shot.
You know, you're also quoted in our piece talking about paid reviews, and I have to admit that caught my eye. I did not expect to think that publishers would have to pay for reviews, and I'm interested to see that you are aware of this game and kind of refuse to play it. I was wondering if you could talk to us about that.
I'm glad you asked that, because I want to learn more about that as well.
Yeah.
Well, we should start charging. And the San Francisco Book Review, which has several permutations, all of them, I routinely send out review copies of and advanced galleys and all of that to about 80 to 100 different publications. And I will routinely get back emails saying, you've qualified for a review. Pay us, you know, $185 and we'll review your book. And it's just like, no. And then the other side of that coin is that the major journals, Publishers Weekly, Book List, Library Journal, all of those have gradually moved towards not paying enough attention to you unless you buy ads. And those are enormously expensive ads. And mm-hmm. I spent, you know, $25,000 last year on advertising. And, you know, that's a drop in the bucket of what they expect. I mean, that barely gets you any presence.
Wow, I feel a little foolish. I should know better, but I had no idea. We've been doing it wrong all these years.
Well, you know, it's very confusing to me.
You've got the high ground.
Yeah, and we know what kind of value attaches to that.
I was wondering if you feel that this sort of arrangement is unique to the publishing industry. I mean, you know, Brad and I have both worked in entertainment journalism. You know, bands send in albums. They don't also send in a check, so you'll review them. That seems odd to me.
Yeah, it is odd, and it's something that's changed remarkably just in the last 10 years.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. You can find out more about Texas's independent publishers by reading Independent Publishers Make Their Presence Felt at the 2014 Texas Book Festival on TexasObserver.org. Bryce Milligan and Brad Tyre, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks again, Bryce.
That's it for Observer Radio this week. But before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer for this episode is Leah Manners. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at TexasObserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.